Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare. We're going to, it is Thursday, April 27th, and we're going to start with our informational hearing first. It's a Health Policy Institute study. Georgia Coolidge had organized this for us. It's the projected supply of dentists and access to dental care in Oregon, and I would love to bring forward Dr. Marco Fujisic.
Good.
Okay.
Impressive. Well, thank you for having me with you today. I'm visiting from Chicago. I'm Marco Fujisic. I'm the chief economist and vice president of the Health Policy Institute. This is a branch of the American Dental Association that focuses on research and data and numbers. And I head that group up, and today I was asked to just review some new research we have specific to Oregon on access to dental care.
Great. And just for your information, my son-in-law and daughter and two grandkids live in Northbrook, just north of Chicago.
Oh, okay.
So love that area, actually.
Okay, well, I love visiting here, too.
All right.
I've been a few times. And just to kind of give you a little bit of background, again, these are just some screenshots. You've received these slides ahead of time, I hope. This is the type of research we do. We're very science-oriented. These are some of the top policy journals in the field, including the New England Journal of Medicine and Health Affairs. This is our gold standard, to just show you that the work we do is scientific, peer-reviewed, and credible. This is to show you that it's interesting and relevant, which is something different. This is just some news stories in the last few months, citing either interviews with myself or citing our research. So I basically have three things to discuss with you today. And please stop me at any time. I was told we can keep this informal. I can go on and on about data, but that can be boring, so please just stop and ask for any insights as we go along. One is to put Oregon in perspective relative to other states. I want to show you some data looking at oral health outcomes in Oregon relative to the rest of the U.S. I want to go over this this new analysis that we've presented, which, by the way, was peer-reviewed by Echo Northwest, which you're familiar with here. And I think more importantly, give you my big picture takeaways. I am not an academic. I am not a policymaker like you. I sit in between. Basically, the reason why we do this analysis is to help guide decisions within the OHA and at the policy level for committees like yourself. So I'll give you my big picture takeaways. Okay, so here we go. This is the percent of children covered by public insurance, in your case OHP, who have a dental visit. And we're comparing trends over time in Oregon with the national average. So Oregon is the blue line. The U.S. average is orange, and you see here basically general upward trends over time, meaning more and more children covered by Medicaid and CHIP in the U.S. have been able to visit a dentist. Now, you see, importantly, with Oregon, you've had a flat line the past few years, meaning that the upward trends have kind of stopped. To put it in perspective of all the states, basically, if you're on the left side of this chart, you have relatively low dental care use among publicly insured children. And if you're on the right, you have relatively high. So you're on the left side here, meaning, again, lower than average and not much progress the past few years. So just some important context. The last thing is, this is a complicated chart, so I'll just summarize. Basically, we also look at children with private dental insurance as a comparison group. So all we're measuring here is the percent of children in OHP who visit a dentist compared to children in Oregon with private dental coverage, right? And if you're on the right side of this chart, it means you have a relatively large gap between those populations. And that's where Oregon lies, meaning that privately insured kids in this state actually visit the dentist a lot. It's not that there's some general trend in Oregon that people aren't visiting the dentist. You actually have one of the largest gaps between OHP-covered children and children with private dental insurance in terms of their probability that they visit a dentist. And by the way, this 42% number, I want you to keep that in mind, okay? So remember, 42% of children in OHP had a dental visit in the past year. Okay, that's an important number. Okay, switching to adults, we don't have equivalent data, which is a separate conversation. We should, but we don't do the same kind of effort on the data side for adults. But I do want to just show you some new data that we partnered with Harris Poll 2 years ago to procure. These are data just for Oregon, and it's for adults. And we're measuring the impact of oral health issues on their lives. So these are not clinical exams that dentists do. We're asking adults in Oregon, hey, are oral health issues affecting your day-to-day life? And you see here, I just want to draw some statistics. Basically, 1 out of 5 low-income adults in this state say that they very often have difficulty biting and chewing because of oral health issues. Okay? 22% say that they avoid smiling frequently because of oral health issues. All right. Now, if you're kind of less into those kind of pulling the heartstrings, I'll focus your attention on the right side here. It's about jobs. Right? 41% of low-income adults in Oregon say that the condition of their mouth and teeth affects their ability to interview for a job. So this is an economic cost to your state. And I pulled this one out because it's among the highest. I'm not sure if you are the highest, but it's in the top three. So obviously, the takeaway from this is that oral health issues, especially for low-income adults, in my view, are having a pretty strong effect negatively on people's lives. Okay, and then we asked adults why they don't go to the dentist more. Again, we asked them, do you think it's important? Do you value oral health? I didn't show you those charts. Universal agreement. It's important. We value it. We love to go. When asked why, the top reason by far is cost. Okay, and we'll come back to this. Basically, low-income adults report heavy financial barriers to accessing oral care. And reason number 2 is fear, and reason number 3, convenience. As you see there, finding a provider is not a very prominent reason. And we'll come back to that. That has some important implications. Okay, so to the two studies, again, that were peer-reviewed by EquiNorthwest, you're not expected to see these dots. I'm going to explain them, but just to show you that we've done a couple pieces. The first is this one. We built a complicated model to project the supply of dentists in your state. This is a lot of equations, but basically it takes account of retirement patterns. It takes account of where graduates from all dental schools in the U.S., how many of those actually locate in Oregon, new dentists. It looks at migration across state lines. What's your net? And the punchline here is that we project that the supply of dentists will grow in Oregon through 2035. Now, this chart takes account of population growth. So the number of practicing dentists will actually grow faster than the projected population of Oregon, meaning you're getting a net gain in supply. This is important. A lot of states are seeing this. A lot of states are seeing declines. You happen to have one of the youngest dentist populations in the land. Some states on the East Coast have very aging dentist populations, and it wouldn't look like this. But the punchline here is I am comfortable saying that the overall supply of dentists in Oregon will grow in the near future. Moving now to the geographic access. So we wanted to say, okay, well, that's interesting, but that's treating Oregon like one market. Let's actually look at the location of providers and the location of your people, your citizens. And so we did some pretty data-intensive analyses, and I just want to walk you through this. So what we're able to do is we're able to plot dental offices, public facilities with dental care, and dental schools that have clinics that treat the population. We're able to put those on a map. And through other data sources, we're able to figure out which of those locations has a dentist that is enrolled as an OHP provider. Basically, they have enrolled to be a provider in the public insurance program. And we know which ones don't participate in OHP. And then we use detailed census data to plot the population. So we know where low-income children live, and we know where the general population lives. And then we do some complicated geomath. I don't want to bore you with it, but if you just focus on the map on the right, you'll see this yellow cloud cover. What we've done is we've constructed 15-minute travel times around dental offices that participate in OHP. And so the idea here is if you live underneath that yellow cloud cover, you live within a 15-minute travel time of a dentist that has agreed to participate in OHP as a provider.
And you use DCOs. Our DCOs, they have primarily our Medicaid population. They're a part of this data?
So they are a part, but there's much more refined data that we have.
Okay.
But it would come from your state's Medicaid office, your OHP, that basically has a roster that they submit to federal CMS. But it would include those providers, yes.
What's frustrating for me is because I know out of the three very good friends of mine, who are dentists, two do not take Medicaid, and it looks like there's a whole lot of red dots that they do not participate
they do not.
In
right.
Medicaid. But
right.
you can't make money on Medicaid.
Yeah, we'll
and that's
get to
the
that.
Main reason, and yeah. I'm frustrated with that.
Yeah. So the first question I hope you are thinking, and the first question my team asked is, well, okay, let's do some basic calculations. What percent of OHP-covered children live underneath this yellow cloud cover? Are you with me? What percent are within a 15-minute travel time to a dentist that accepts their insurance? Right? And that really surprised us. It's 91%, which is very high, meaning that 91% of publicly insured children in your state live within 15 minutes of a dentist, at least one, that is enrolled to be an OHP provider. Okay. Remember what I told you in the first 3 minutes. 42% of these children are actually visiting a dentist. Right? So you have 42% that are visiting a dentist, 91% that have fairly good geographic access. So something's breaking down in between. I want to be very clear what these data measure and what they don't. They don't measure whether people are accepting patients at convenient times or within the next 2 days or accepting patients at all. We don't have access to that level of data. This is just people who have enrolled and agreed to participate in the program. So the next thing we had to do was to say, well, okay, that's interesting, but let's say there's one dentist for like 10,000 kids. That's different than if there's 50 dentists per 10,000 kids. So we did some more fancy math, and we split up your state into four colors, right? The gray are areas where there is no 15-minute access. That's where the people live who do not have any provider who accepts OHP within 15 minutes. The green, yellow, and red are the 91% that do, and we divide them into kind of three bands. Green is basically there are a ton of dentists. Yellow is there are not a ton, but there are a lot. And then red is, yes, there is at least one, but not really a lot. Right? So most of your state actually is in this green band, right? Which says of those 91, the vast majority are actually in these green plots where there are, I mean, not to bore you, but at least one dentist for every 500 publicly insured kids. Okay. So when we rack and stack Oregon against different states, you end up having a different picture here than those first few plots. You're actually above average. So you have relatively good geographic coverage of dentists that accept public insurance. So like Senator Beyer, if we look in your area, you know, you have a mix of green. You have actually a mix of every color around your area, in your district. So you have some areas where there isn't coverage, you have some where it's great, and some where, same with you, Senator Cruz, if we look at Roseburg, you have all the colors around you. So not to go too much into this, but the audience for something like this really is the technical people in OHA, right? So when we work with other states, this basically lets them say, okay, well, where should we focus on recruiting more providers, right? That's the gray areas. And where do we have okay coverage, which is the green, right? And then maybe the red is another priority area. We have some, but we need to recruit more. But generally, when we look at this, your geographic access, at least according to the data we have, is pretty good. We repeat this now for all the population and all dentists. So we're no longer focusing on the OHP beneficiaries, but all population, all dentists. Again, the punchline's kind of the same. You have 94% of your population lives within 15 minutes of a dentist. Right? And again, here the vast majority are in those green zones. Right? So here again, if I look at the whole population, Oregon relative to the rest of the states, you're on the right side, meaning you have above average coverage. Right?
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Yes, Senator Byer.
Thank you. Why did you pick 15 minutes? I mean, it seems like a strange time mark.
Good question. So we did the calculations for 5, 15, and 30 minutes, right? Because we are releasing this for all states in like a compendium, we had to make a choice. Now, when we work, we have several states we're working with as follow-ups that have told us, well, we want 30 minutes in these areas. Can you do that? Absolutely. So if there's an opportunity to do follow-up work, we could replicate this for 30-minute travel times. My point here is these numbers are going to be even higher.
Yeah.
Right? So to me, my guess is we'll do that and we'll find even better coverage.
Yes, Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you. You may be getting to this a little bit more, but just as insurance doesn't equal access, physical proximity doesn't equal access. Are you going to be talking a little bit more about wait times for appointments and things like that?
So, Senator, this is a vital question. What exactly are we measuring?
Right.
So on the provider side, again, we're not measuring, are you accepting a patient tomorrow at a convenient time? Are you meaningfully participating?
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
I mean, I don't expect tomorrow, but I do expect sometime sooner than 2 or 3 months from now.
Yeah. So one thing we don't have access to those data, and I haven't seen similar studies in Oregon. I can tell you in other states that have done like a mystery shopper, where you have researchers pose as patients, or you look at claims data, right? All this is feasible. We're working with other states, my team, to actually crunch those kind of numbers. I do know a state like Connecticut did this kind of mystery shopper analysis, and they found that 92% of the providers that were enrolled as participating providers were accepting new patients, the vast majority within 6 days.
That's
now,
great.
That may not be the case here, but I don't have those information, but it can be done.
Great. Yeah. Thank you very much.
And then just the last thing, because this actually is something that I think is part of Senator Steiner-Hayward's question is, well, let's say we do have providers participating, but maybe limiting their volume or limiting appointment times, et cetera. Why might that be? And I think part of it, I do want to flag for you, and Senator Mona Sanderson, you mentioned this. Reimbursement is extremely low for dental care services within OHP. So let me just clarify what you're seeing on the chart. We analyzed the fee-for-service reimbursement schedules for state Medicaid offices across the country, and we created a measure of what they're paying relative to typical private insurance. Okay, both on the medical side and the dental side. And as you see here, you are on the bottom of these charts, which are just two different measures. But the punchline here is relative to other states, the reimbursement levels for dental care within OHP are low compared to the private insurance market. And so I think that's something important you may want to look at. We also
I can't read. Is the blue is what's the caption say? What blue and purple?
So
are?
We just divide states. Some states operate their dental care or their Medicaid programs through managed care, and we count you as one of those. You're a little bit unique because you have a CCO model. Some states operate their Medicaid programs through fee-for-service, so it's just important to divide those states. That's what the colors are.
Okay.
Yeah. But even if we did this blind to colors, Oregon would be near the bottom. And I think it's important to just flag that we also did the equivalent calculations for physician reimbursement. So for medical care services, and it's important to note that you reimburse medical services here much more generously than the dental services. So, for example, some states that pay low on the dental side also pay low universally for all health care. You're not one of those. You have the dental side being relatively low reimbursement, but you have the medical side being kind of much more generous. And again, I don't know the background of all that, but that's what the data say. So let me just kind of end with two buckets of takeaways. One is what the data show, and then the second one is me saying what I see in the data. So number one, I think we can agree that geographic coverage of dental care providers is quite extensive. Again, this is simply geographic proximity. The supply of dentists is expected to grow steadily. Yet, dental care use among publicly insured kids is low here, especially relative to the high geographic coverage numbers. And we do have pretty compelling data that the main barriers to dental care, at least for adults, relate to cost and fear, and not necessarily I can't find a provider. Okay, now I pulled...
One question.
Yes.
When you're saying among adults, does this mean... every resident, every citizen, we have a lot of immigrants and undocumented, and so I was wondering how those numbers get into that.
Great. So, Senator, this is based on a representative sample of adults in the state. So it would mimic whatever your profile is of adults by income, by ethnicity, et cetera. We do break down in the report, we do break this down by income. So, you know, for low-income adults, cost is still the top barrier big time. For middle and high-income adults, it also is one of the top barriers. I'm not exactly sure if it's the top. But a lot of that detail, I'm sorry, I don't have it in my head, but it's in the analysis. So I have three big picture takeaways again. And I do want to say I've visited 2-3 times here in the last 3 years. I deliberately tried to come here as often as I can as somebody that works with states across the country. I think you're doing wonderful things in your CCO movement, in your embrace of the triple aim, and you are doing a lot of innovation. So I'm really anxious to come back here and keep learning. I do want to flag that I think in terms of what OHA may focus more on, one message I take away from this is I think we need to focus less on pure supply interventions, like more providers, and focus much more on this connection issue. Why is it that we have this great geographic coverage but relatively low use? Something is breaking down there, right? Either the beneficiaries don't know where to go for care, or they're calling and they're not getting open appointments. This deserves some further investigation. And by the way, I put there this idea of nudging diabetics. I appreciate the fiscal situation in your state and a lot of other states. I think it's important, though, we have compelling evidence that wasn't around 5 years ago, that improved oral health can actually reduce medical care costs among certain groups. Right.
I've been saying you don't know me, but I'm a physician, and I've been saying this on this dais for as long as I've been in the legislature. It's impossible to control someone's diabetes if they have poor oral health. It's impossible to control someone's heart disease if they have poor oral health. And until people understand that, and understand that we need to stop chopping people off at the neck with dental and vision and mental health, we're never going to make progress at the level we should. So the data are very clear about the intersection between all those things. So I just want to reinforce that point because it's so important, and that's why thinking about issues such as this are so important.
So, Senator, I think I'll just jump to my third point because I fully agree with you. The question then becomes, how do you accelerate this integration in a more meaningful way? Senator, if I've captured that, to me is the next challenge. Is if we accept that there are these benefits, and oral health, rather than being a line item cost driver, is actually viewed more as an investment I mean, 41% of low-income adults saying, I have job interview challenges because of my mouth. I mean, that is an economic cost that up until now we haven't been able to capture. I don't know the emergency room spending for oral health pain in your state. If it's like other states, it's concerning and it's a waste of money. That is not the proper setting to treat conditions like oral pain.
When I was talking with my hospital that's in my district, they were saying that 50% of the ED visits could be attributed to oral health and responding to pain or infection control is all that they can do. Yes, so yeah.
So just to close, I think there's an opportunity here to accelerate innovation in what I call meaningful integration. You have a bill before you today, I believe, that talks about this. I feel there is the right building blocks in your state as a leader in the CCO, ACO movement, in the leader towards the value-based healthcare movement, to basically nudge the payment and delivery models towards outcomes and value when it comes to oral care, right? So I would urge you to kind of consider OHAs, or nudging OHA to start prioritizing some of that. How do you meaningfully integrate? We shouldn't have 41% of people saying oral conditions affect my job interview, right? I think you can have medical care cost savings potentially with improved oral health that may pay for themselves. So you're on the right track, and I hope this was helpful. And to me, I hope you continue to accelerate this movement and so we can continue learning from you.
Yeah. Great.
So thank you.
And great information. And this is on OLIS. I didn't bring my computer, so yeah.
It is.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you so much.
Sure.
All right. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2339A.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2339A prohibits non-participating facility-based providers and providers in emergency cases from balance billing, requires insurers to pay non-participating family-based providers a reasonable customary rate, specifies that the reimbursement formula for non-emergency services equals 175% of the amount paid by Medicare. There is a no revenue impact, and that's on OLIS, and it has a minimal fiscal impact. There's also a dash A6 on OLIS, which clarifies prohibition on balance billing applies to non-emergency situations where customers or consumers are unable to choose their provider.
Pat Allen.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This is an agency bill on an issue that has been around for a long while that we've been working on for some months. Just in super brief, surprise billing is the notion that you went for a procedure of some sort, you did everything that you were supposed to do in terms of making sure your doctor was in network, that you went to a facility that was in network, and somewhere along the line, something that you didn't anticipate turns out to have been out of network, and you get a bill for the remainder, which is perfectly allowable under state law. Typically, this will show up in areas like anesthesiology or pathology, lab work, those kinds of things. It also shows up in emergency medicine. We've been working with a variety of stakeholders, as I say, for a number of months on this proposal. Everyone seems to concede that this is a relatively infrequent problem in terms of perhaps 3 to 5% of interactions where this crops up. But the problem is that the breakdown can be really profound for the individuals who get caught up in it. Let me give you a handful of examples, and these are from our complaint files, of which we've got about 300 over the last several years of these kinds of circumstances turning up. RC is a Brookings woman who went in for a no-cost share annual preventive PAP exam, and the lab work was sent to an out-of-network pathology lab, and the disputed amount that she got a bill back for was about $97. Now, again, under the Affordable Care Act, this is coverage that you're supposed to be able to get at no cost to encourage you to get this preventive work. And in her case, and I think in many of our cases, it wouldn't occur to wonder was the lab in network or out of network. Lest you think lab work is the sort of thing that, well, it happens, but it's $100, so is that a really big deal? SD is a grants pass man who went to an in-network provider, and he had labs sent to an out-of-network pathologist, and that bill came back for $4,378 in that particular case. RG is a Richland, Oregon man who's had scheduled surgery and ended up using an out-of-network anesthesiologist. I've had the great privilege to interact with anesthesiologists neurologists over time, and it never occurred to me to ask whether they were in the same network as the physician or the provider that I was dealing with. That bill was over $1,300. I like this one. Like isn't the right word. CM submitted a complaint on behalf of her son, AM. They're from Hermiston. CM's premature son was admitted to the NICU shortly after birth due to pneumonia, and the provider presiding over the NICU was out of network. So think about that for a minute. Your premature kid is potentially, I don't know, maybe dying of pneumonia, and the first question you're supposed to ask the doctor is, do you take Blue Cross, right? In that case, the bill was $3,742. Just a couple more quick ones because they illustrate yet a different area. KF is a Beaverton man who received emergency surgery from an out-of-network surgeon. In that case, his bill was over $5,000. DT, a man from Boring, and note, those are both urban Portland metropolitan area circumstances. Again, emergency surgery. His bill was over $14,000 from the surgeon. And these are cases where it's an emergent condition, and presumably you're in probably not the best ability to ask any kinds of questions about the coverage. So this is a problem that, as I say, affects a relatively small number of instances, but with profound impacts when it does occur. What 2339, in the A amended version does is basically limit the amount that can be billed for that service to 175% of Medicare rates. This is patterned after about a dozen states have tried to tackle this issue. This is patterned closely after a California law that is in place, which actually provides for reimbursement at a much lower 125% rate. Importantly, nothing about this prevents providers from entering into contracts with the insurers so that we don't have the out-of-network circumstance in this small percentage that occurs. And they can contract at whatever rate they're able to contract at. This tries to deal with the small number of circumstances that occurs where right now it's the consumer that pays the price of the inability of the parties to reach a contract. And that just seems fundamentally unfair, and that's what this bill tries to address. I'd be happy to answer questions that you might have.
I would like to know why you chose the 175% Medicare rate, and why, and a little bit about your knowledge of the FAIR Health data.
Sure. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, the 175% number was actually a negotiated compromise from our original drafting, which was at 125%. We're trying to thread a needle of protecting consumers with a reasonable rate, but not providing a disincentive to arriving at a contract. If the rate becomes too high, it's better for the provider to simply use that too high rate and not the contracted rate. In terms of Fair Health versus Medicaid, we became aware back in the fall of the Fair Health issue. We've got concerns about the use of the Fair Health database in a couple of senses. To the extent that we can understand what's in Fair Health, it appears to be basically a version of reasonable and customary fees, which is pretty close to what the current system is. And we've done some analysis looking at various comparisons and find Fair Health, the Fair Health proposal that we've heard consistently higher than the 175% of Medicaid. But I mentioned to the extent that we can tell what's there, our biggest problem is that the Fair Health database is largely proprietary and non-transparent. So it's very difficult to tell what's in that database and how it plays into this issue.
So that's more chargeable rates than actual what's paid.
Well, it would result in the examples that we've been able to research looking at various databases, we find a consistently higher payment rate. For instance, tissue examination by pathologists. This is 88 through 05 diagnosis code. $235 is what 80% of Fair Health would get you versus $118.96 based on 175% of Medicaid. An ER visit of high severity, $836 versus $200. Kinds of disparities.
Gotcha. Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. Do we have any sense? I understand that contracts between insurers and providers are often confidential, but do we have any sense or any way to determine what those contracts end up looking like? I mean, what percentage of Medicare, because it's Medicare, right, not Medicaid?
Correct.
What percentage of Medicare do those contracts generally provide? Do we have any way of understanding that?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, the contracts are confidential, and to the extent I actually know what's in them, I can't say anything about them. I can say that when we worked through stakeholder processes to be able to get to what that final price was, there was a number floated over on the House side that was at 225% of Medicaid, and that ran into pretty consistent feedback that was above what was typically being paid now, and that 175 was about as high as you could go without running into that perverse incentive kind of a territory.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Did the work group have any conversations about why these providers are not contracting? Is it simply because they don't think they're being reimbursed enough by the insurers, or is it because the credentialing is too complicated, which we hope we'll deal with the new common credentialing program, or did that conversation come up at all?
Yeah, to answer that, I'm going to ask Don Jagger from our office to come up, who worked directly with the work group.
Thank you. Because I would just say, while she's coming up, I mean, we don't hear about this happening with primary care providers. We don't hear about this happening a lot with the kinds of people you tend to schedule to see.
Cardiology,
it tends to be the people, as you alluded to, who are sort of behind the scenes or you don't have much choice about. Right, as opposed to those of us who are on the front lines all the time.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, my name is Dawn Jagger, and I'm with the Department of Consumer and Business Services as a senior health policy advisor, and you are spot on. The providers were concerned that the contracted rates were too low in those areas. That is what we heard during the stakeholder process.
And I don't know if you can answer this question. Maybe it'll be more appropriate when some of the representatives of some of the specialties come up, but do we have any sense, for example, what percentage of NICU physicians are contracted, or anesthesiologists or pathologists are contracted with the majority of our prominent carriers?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, I think that really is in the aggregate, that's the data that underlies the 3 to 5% are where there's a breakdown, and that the vast majority of these cases have contracted arrangements or billed rates that don't run into this problem.
Senator Byer? No. Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to bring Patty O'Sullivan and Dan Bissell and Hans Nottenboom up first. And Patty, you go first so you can go and rest.
You sick, Patty?
Great. And I'm feeling great, don't worry. But I know you're here in case I crap out.
Yes, ma'am. Right here. Always there for you, Patty.
Great. Thank you. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan, and I'm representing the College of American Pathologists and the Oregon Association of Pathologists today. And Senator Byer, welcome to the Healthcare Committee. First time I've testified in front of you, well, in this committee. We represent 17,000 pathologists nationally and 135 in Oregon. Radiologists are not represented on this issue, but when you think about the issues with pathologists that I'll mention, they tend to fall into the radiology arena too. And that issue is that sometimes scans and x-rays and pathology has to be sent out of the hospital because of the specialty of it. Routine things can be done there, but there's specialty doctors that need to look at, compound fractures or head CTs and things like that. And in pathology, there are some tests that are too complicated to do in a regular hospital lab. Not all hospitals, but some, especially when you get to the more rural areas. So that's why you get the out-of-network, because they might be out of state, or they might be in Portland when you're in Medford, and you don't take the same, you don't have the same insurance companies to be on the panel. So just, and one of the things that was said was talking about why providers won't join networks, and really it's a dual issue. It's not just why they won't join networks because of they want more money. The flip side of that is network adequacy and narrow networks that you will hear probably testimony from people that say, well, they wouldn't let me join. They want to keep a narrow focus. And so some people are denied joining. So it's really probably a 50-50 kind of a thing. It's not just the providers and it's not just the insurers. It's a network adequacy issue. So, and that's not in this bill, but that is really what's happening. You're going to hear a lot of testimony today. So I'm going to just start by saying we fully absolutely support taking the patients out of the billing issues. We have no problem with that part of the bill. Obviously, the part of the bill that I think everybody has a problem with is then what happens to the payment. We support the -6 language because we think that makes that issue a little clearer. I saw a email earlier from OSEP, and I do agree with their a little bit of a language change, but we're fine with the -6s. And we oppose the use of Medicare reimbursement rates. It's not just that they're low, which they are, but you know, I worked for OHA for many, many years, and I've done healthcare for a long time. I've been in front of you hundreds of times, probably. And one of the things that that it has always been avoided was putting specific rates in statute, telling insurers or patients exactly how much, or Medicaid, how much they should reimburse. It's usually on a list and things change. So this would sort of set a precedent, and there's other bills in this building going around right now, that this precedent, if passed, setting it at a fairly low rate of Medicare, would enter into. This issue is being looked at nationally in all the states. And Pat mentioned California, which settled on 125%. Well, they're having some issues. They California surgeons and doctors filed a lawsuit, and the three issues that they filed the lawsuit on was constitutional issues with the due process, with insurers setting rates with non-contracted entities, equal protections, access for poor people, because if doctors then pull out of those areas because they get this low rate and do something else and join a network somewhere else, that access for poor people, this is in the lawsuit, and the takings clause, not paying market value for services. And it was filed in October in the District Court, Eastern District, California, and I can get you a copy of that if you like. It was pretty thick, so I didn't bring it. Medicare does not, first of all, does not cover all the procedures. Medicare was made for seniors and people that are severely, children that that are medically fragile and disabled. And it doesn't cover every type of pathology test. So we have some things that are sort of left out. I'm not sure how that would be handled. Again, the precedent that we're setting is not good. The rates are built on a budget. This is how much the Medicare budget is, and then you have to divvy it up. It has no bearing on what the service costs. And in the current atmosphere in D.C., you know, the fear is that those rates are going to go way down when the Medicare budget, if and when the Medicare budget is cut severely. So we're setting a rate on something that we have no control over. The insurers or us have no control over what DC does and what happens with Medicare rates. If it goes way, way down, it's great for insurers, but because they save money, but it's not so great for providers. Medicare rates in Oregon already historically low, so that would make them even lower. And they can kind of go up and down on a whim. I have a chart with 12 states with current out-of-network balance billing prohibitions that have passed. Only one, California, hooked up to Medicare. The majority prohibited balance billing but set no rate of reimbursement and sort of went into a mediation arbitration thing, which can be very expensive, but just said, you guys go work it out. 80th percentile of Fair Health is in New York. Usual and customary language is in Florida. Usual and customary is also something that you can get from Fair Health, but they didn't specifically mention that. But so that's where those states are sitting. Obviously, the majority of them didn't pick a rate because they're having as many, they had as many problems trying to pick one as we are here. So, and other options are available, which I gave a couple of you a sheet of paper with some other options that you could do. You could do sideboards, have a high and low, and say, okay, you guys figure it out somewhere in the middle. You could have a Florida language is the lesser of three things, usual, customary, what the person, what the provider charged, or what you've agreed upon, the lesser of those three things. That's language that is, you know, something we could work on. And also to let you know, these are just little tidbits I've picked up along the way. Aetna and United Insurance, Aetna is in all 50 states. United Insurance, I'm not sure exactly how many states they're in. But they set Fair Health as their out-of-network payment automatically already. So they already do it. And the insurers in this state, I don't know if it's all of them, but I believe all the big ones, provide, give their data to Fair Health. So the fact that everybody's confused about Fair Health, yeah, it's complicated. So is Medicaid. I worked with it for years. It's very complicated. Healthcare is not easy, and I think I heard that lately from D.C. It's very complicated. I don't think you knew that.
Surprise, no, surprise,
we
surprise.
We all knew it. So with that, I just want to make sure I covered all my points. Oh, the confusing thing. I've heard two things from DCBS that on why they are pushing so hard for Medicare. One is that it's confusing, and they just can't figure it out. They don't know what's in the database. Of course, we don't know what's in the contracts for insurers with their contracted providers either. But so, you know, there's all the proprietary stuff. But the our insurance companies do send them data. And, you know, I mean, I worked for state government for 33 years. I don't think I ever came to a committee and said, we don't want to do that in OHA or DHS or DCBS, because I represented them too, because it's very confusing and it's hard for us. Well, you have actuaries and people, you know. I mean, I don't see that as a reason, but that's just me. I was never allowed to say it, I'll tell you. And the other thing is that the other reason that I heard was we need to make sure that insurance companies remain solvent. And right now they're losing money. Okay, but this is affecting 2 or 3% of claims, first of all. But what it does do is set a precedent. And that's why people want it really low, because you have your OEB-PEB bill, you have all kinds of other things going on that will grab this. The state of Washington is watching us right now. And they're going to probably try to adopt whatever we adopt here. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Let's have the panel first.
Sure.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Chairwoman Anis Anderson, Senator Cruz, Vice Chair, thank you for having me today. My name is Dan Bissell. I'm a practicing emergency physician and also CEO and president of Northwest Acute Care Specialists, the state's largest independent emergency physician group. We see over 300,000 patients, roughly, in predominantly the Portland metro area, and we have approximately 150 providers. I wanted to speak for a minute today specifically about the bill before us and the potential impact on the emergency care safety network. As has already been outlined, the scope of the problem on the one hand is small. Less than 3% of those 300,000 visits are affected by balance billing. And the dollar amount from emergency physician standpoint is small. Our bills tend to be on the order of hundreds of dollars, not the multi-thousand dollar bills that you hear. However, the impact is large. The impact is large on particularly the patient, and that's where the greatest common ground is on this bill. Both the providers and the insurers and the DCBS all agree that patients should not be caught in the middle of this process. The issue really comes, obviously, to this issue of reimbursement. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about how and why we enter into contracts with payers, and a little bit about what the impact of setting a very low rate tied to Medicare would have on that emergency care safety network. So we enjoy contracts with the vast majority of all of the payers in the region. That reflects the fact that only 3% of those 300,000 visits are out of network. The reason that we enter into contracts with payers is it's good business in terms of our own business and also in terms of our client. And in my case, Legacy Health is our client. And so we have over years aimed to establish multi-year contracts with payers, with insurers, that allow for very small gradual increases in rates. Our rates gradually increase on the order of 1% to 2% a year in most contracts. That's rather different as a consumer and a person who purchases healthcare for my own family. My private insurance rates seem to go up by 10 to 12% a year. So there's a disconnect there. And it's in our best interest to maintain those contracts because we establish good and valuable relationships with those payers. Being out of network is actually more problematic for us, even though theoretically we could potentially make more money that way. It creates more problems with patients, which we don't want. They're our client. And with our hospital system. The other issue here is that we are part of the backbone of the emergency care network. And by that I mean there's a lot of debate right now as to what healthcare should be in this country, but one thing is certain. All Oregonians, everyone in this room, has an anticipation that if they have an urgent problem, they can go to an ER and get immediate care and expert care and a full range of care, whatever that problem may be. In fact, we're federally mandated to see anyone, no matter their ability to pay or their condition, and we pride ourselves on that fact. The reality is the ability to enter and exit contracts is the only capacity we have to maintain that payer network. And so the only reason that I ever go out of network with a payer is because there is a fundamental disagreement there. And it happens rarely, but it does happen. And I have to be able to have that leverage in order to bring that payer back to the table in order to establish better parity in that relationship. Unfortunately, there are cases where payers stop paying their claims at all for a period of months, 8 months last year. One pair. And so there needs to be in any economic market the capacity to enter and exit from contracts, and there needs to be parity in that market so that both sides can agree on a fair middle ground. The established rates that are proposed here, for example, the 125% that was quoted in California, would reflect roughly a 50% cut for the average emergency physician. Left under those auspices, there would be no incentive for payers to enter into contracts because it's much cheaper to be out of network. That would lead then to specialists who don't have to take emergency calls saying, I'm not going to take emergency call because I'm not going to get reimbursed for that work, which means in the ER we will have a thinner and thinner panel of people able to respond to those emergencies. And similarly, emergency physicians will start to say, I'm not going to practice in this state because those reimbursement rates get so low. And in fact, that's exactly what we've seen play out in the California example and why there are lawsuits there and why that exact rate is under discussion there, because it's had a substantial negative impact on their emergency safety network. I'll end there, but I'm happy to take any questions.
Let's have the final one.
Chair Monis-Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz and committee, thanks for having me. My name is Hans Notenboom. I'm also a practicing emergency physician. I come out of Eugene, Oregon, where we see about 100,000 Oregon residents. I'm currently the president of the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. I think there's been a lot of good points just made. I think I'm going to try to summarize or wrap some of those up. And I think to start off, we would say that OSEP agrees that we should be putting the patient at the center of this situation. We also agree, and I think there is the most common ground, that we want the patient to be taken out of the middle of this situation. How we do that is the trick. So as we go forward, what is the actual problem? Emergency physicians are seeing patients who have delayed care because of concern about high out-of-pocket costs. Whether that's deductibles, coinsurance, or copays, the patients are facing higher premiums for the health insurance, but getting less coverage. In effect, insurance companies then are shifting those costs of medical care from the patients to the patients and the medical providers from the insurance companies. Banning the practice of balanced billing without a fair and transparent method of reimbursement creates huge benefits for these insurance companies at the expense of the providers, as well as the patients and the medical safety net. It allows health plans to basically arbitrarily set unfair rates for provider services. And as was the question with Senator Steiner Hayward regarding why do we see it in this population and not the more urgent population, again, that relates to the federal EMTALA laws that were passed at the urging, basically, of emergency physicians who saw patients turned away for acute services based on their inability to pay. And as a result, we're proud to be the safety net. In fact, we see the majority of indigent patients in the state through emergency departments, as well as about two-thirds of the Medicare community. House Bill 2339 sets up two tiers of provider reimbursement, that of non-emergency services, which is the Medicare rate of 175%, and then for emergency services, rates will be tied to the complicated greatest of three rule. And basically, the greatest of three rule will take the median amount less copays and deductibles negotiated for in-network providers, the median negotiated for out-of-network providers, are the amount paid by Medicare for the same or similar service in a geographic area. Here's where our concern is. This greatest of three rule for emergency care is completely unenforceable. The Emergency Department Practice Management Association says medicine reimbursement has gone down after this standard was implemented at the federal level. In fact, the rate is actually subject to a current legal challenge by the American College of Emergency Physicians at the federal level. Insurers then determine their reimbursement levels and formulas in private, as we've discussed earlier. And there's no way for emergency physicians to check if they're getting paid at the same as the out-of-network providers, meaning that the standard's extremely vague. So, again, considering that physicians in Oregon are, especially emergency physicians in Oregon, are bound to the EMTALA guidelines, providing indigent care, providing two-thirds of the Medicaid acute care in emergency departments, this means that they have little operating margin and can't significantly discount their commercial rates. The reimbursement method would basically destabilize emergency department safety net care, and this is kind of what we've heard earlier in the California situation, as well as kind of the discussion of how this could narrow our call panels. Forcing the out-of-network providers to accept below-market rates might mean that specialists such as surgeons, orthopedists, neurosurgeons, cardiologists, we've already talked about radiologists, anesthesiologists, pathologists, people can stop taking emergency call, and this will create a huge issue, especially in the rural areas where people would move out. Insurance carriers are pushing for this simple solution of Medicare, and I think we've already heard some very valid points on this. The 175% reimbursement rate really cuts the reimbursement rate to upwards of, like Dr. Bissell said, around 50% of what we see now, and that rate, as we have also discussed, is based on kind of an arbitrary budgetary delineated number, not based on cost, not based on the real market value. Therefore, it's a number that doesn't change with the market value at all, which is something that we've also seen. In addition, there's not separate standards. There shouldn't be separate standards for emergency versus non-emergency care, as this will also limit choices in rural areas. So what are the fair reimbursement principles that OSEP stands behind? Again, patients should be taken out of the middle of all of this. It's confusing. This whole subject is very confusing. We've discussed it at many different levels, and it's very confusing for the patient who doesn't know anything about it. From the insurance companies, or the insurance companies must be transparent about how they calculate payments, provide fair coverage for emergency patients. Payments must be based on a reasonable portion of charges rather than these arbitrary Medicare rates that are not based on fair market value. In addition, state law should include acceptable interim minimum benefit standard for out-of-network provider services, and Fair Health is one method that we could use to do that. If there's any other questions, we can provide much more information regarding Fair Health as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, could you share what, just roughly, of what percentage would the 175% be, or how would that relate to what your normal contract for services with the providers that you contract in-network with?
I'm not sure I can give you an exact number there. I can tell you that the initial look, when we initially looked at this, looking at the initial versions of the bill, we were thinking the impact would probably be on the order of 50%. So my guess is it may be slightly above that at 175, but still well below average contracted rates. And again, I think what we're aiming for is parity in that contract market. We don't want them to be as high as contracted rates. That would be silly. But if it's so low, and I understand the insurers don't want it to be so high that we don't want to be in the network, we want to be in network with payers. There's business reasons for us to do that. There's good continuity reasons for us to do that. But if it's so low that the insurers have no desire to be in contract with us, that's the delicate balance we're seeking. And it needs to be on a fair and transparent process. I think, quite honestly, that the idea that the Fair Health Database is opaque is a little disingenuous of the insurance industry, who are very familiar with this data and supply data to the Fair Health Database.
If this is only 2 to 3% of all claims, that means it's maybe just 2 to 3% for your individual claims.
Right. Dave, okay. To minimal impact on the actual dollars that are out of network or that piece, the question is what's the impact on the overall contract market between providers and insurers? That's really the crux of the issue.
Questions? Thank you very much, panel. Tom Holt, Jessica Addison, and Elise Brown.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions here in support of 2339A and the amendment that you have before you. I'd like to just add to some of the testimony you've heard in terms of some context. First, I want to thank DCBS for the work that they've done over now almost a year of many meetings. We've had good, vigorous discussion, and I think, you know, there is a point of agreement in that everyone believes that we should take the consumer out of the middle. Therefore, you don't have an arbitration bill before you, which would make consumers deal with arbitration. We agree that it's a very small percentage of the time that this happens. And as Pat Allen described, though, boy, howdy, when it does, it's a big bill. It's several window envelopes arriving in your mailbox. When we looked at our data, I asked our team to, you know, find for me the numbers on, you know, how big is the bread box? How often does this happen? And what's it look like when it does? And, you know, the answer is essentially what you heard from Pat and others, that it's a small percentage of the claims at hospitals. Principally, this is a hospital-based issue. It's the physician who works, practices at the hospital, is not an employee of the hospital, and they are not the person you get to choose. It's four or five specialties account for 90% plus of these kind of cases. It's radiology, pathology, anesthesiology, a couple of others. Then there's a bunch of onesie-twosie one-off things beyond that. When the consumer gets these bills after the fact, it usually is not just one. It's, you know, and the claims typically look like $800, $900, $1,000, maybe a bit more, but it's two or three of those. And so all of a sudden, a consumer is facing several thousand dollars in costs. Or it might be, you know, some of the, in the outlier cases, you know, many thousands of dollars. And we hear about this all the time from our members and our customers. When I go out and visit with customers and ask them what are their pain points, hands shot up when I mentioned this issue. And our employer customers said, you know, this is the thing that people come to HR departments about. And they say, you know, I thought you were providing us with a good benefit, and I went in for XYZ procedure. I did all the right things, and then I got this bill. What is going on? So this is a really important issue for this body to deal with. We're proud of the fact that we have contracts with most providers in this state in all specialties. In fact, as of a couple of months ago, I'm told that we had contracts with 100% of the ER physician groups. So it really is the outliers. Now, we have no desire to fulfill the fear that was expressed here of walking away from contracting. We have a strong interest in having providers under contract besides the dollars and cents. If a provider is not under contract, then we don't have the ability to really share quality data with them and have conversations about how can we work together to get better outcomes and work on those kinds of programs that we've had other discussions in this committee about. It's very rough for our member in terms of process. When a provider is not in network, then we lose some of the things that we take care of behind the scenes. That's our job as an insurer, to make the billing and that stuff go smoothly for the consumer. We lose all that if someone's not under contract. So the places where we don't have contracts, typically there's really only a couple of issues in play. One, risk of the obvious, it's a small percentage of the time we're just way apart on the dollars and cents. That's something that eventually usually works itself out. Once in a blue moon, it's a quality issue. And it's just not somebody we'd want in our network under any price. That's very, very, very rare. But bottom line is, we want to have most providers in network. Most are. We wouldn't expect, with the solution in this bill, that would really change. And we think that Medicare is a good solution, in that in the industry, everyone kind of understands what those numbers are. It's transparent to those who do contracts for providers. It's transparent to us. We understand what that dynamic is. And I'm frankly puzzled at the emergency doctor's opposition to the greater of piece that's offered to them in the piece of the bill that's mimicking a requirement of the ACA for emergency services in the individual market plans. So we think this is a reasonable solution. It's, what we're not trying to do here is get at exactly level to what providers would otherwise get under contract. We want to be fair and have a level where, their basic operating costs are being covered and that sort of thing. But no, they're not making a profit on these out-of-network situations. But we think it's a fair compensation that keeps an incentive for providers to come to the table and for us to come to the table and hopefully arrive at reasonable agreements. And the last thing I wanted to touch on is just this idea about narrowing of networks. There are products in the market that are network products where you sign up for, I'm going to go to buy a product where I can go to any provider I want if it's in XYZ health system. That's a network product. The industry is not broadly shrinking down networks. These are things that people are sometimes exploring, employers are exploring, but no one wants to leave a member high and dry without access to coverage.
Thank you. Jessica.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. We, too, want to echo much of what you heard from Mr. Holt in Cambia. It's our view, not only as a payer, but certainly as a provider, what we know as a hospital system is when we have folks come in, and in the very rare cases where this occurs, folks don't differentiate between the radiologist or the pathologist and the hospital. From their perspective, this is a problem happening at an in-network hospital. Frankly, consumers shouldn't be held in the middle of what, frankly, is industry contracting quirks. There are reasons why people are in contract or in-network or out-of-network that are difficult to understand even for those in the industry. It's certainly unfair to ask consumers to try and work through that or understand it, which is why this bill really leaves consumers out of it and tries to set a very clear payment amount so that everyone knows what that payment amount is and can be held accountable to making sure that that payment comes in for that amount in the rare instances where this happens. But again, as a provider, we are are very much in a scenario where we don't want folks to be practicing in our hospital either on call or in a regular basis that are not in network, because consumers come to us. They view it as a Providence problem, not as a anesthesiology group problem. So as an integrated system, we work very hard to make sure that our folks are in network. And we believe that it's fair in these instances that there is a balance in the emergency side. The qualified health plan standard that's in the ACA gets folks pretty close to UCR, and we believe that that is appropriate on the 175 of Medicare. As has been noted, that's significantly higher than other states that have set a rate, and I would say that while generally we agree this would set a new precedent in some respects to having a rate in statute, that we believe in this instance, because these are by far the exception, not the rule, that in this instance, in the interest of transparency, in the interest of simplification, it's appropriate to do so. Just a quick word about the -A6 amendments, which we urge you to adopt. This is to provide clarity about instances where people are not surprised. So, for example, at Providence St. Vincent, we have lots of medical groups that lease space in our facility, in the perhaps non-surgical wing of our facility, but just have an office there as a convenience for patients. Those, not all of those groups are going to be under contract with every payer that is in that has a contract with our facility. And in those instances where, say, someone goes to a plastic surgeon who is clearly not in network, where that patient is informed at the consulting appointment that they're not in network, we don't believe that these protections ought to apply in those cases. That's a decision point for that individual to go to and to choose an out-of-network provider. It's not an emergency situation, and it's not a situation where they didn't have a choice. So that's what the A6 amendments do. It was an agreement around the table to clarify that, and this just puts a finer point on that and provides more clarity so that there's not confusion for consumers or for providers about instances where people make that choice as opposed to being surprised with a provider that they had no choice about.
Thank you. Elise. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Elise Brown for America's Health Insurance Plans. And as you know, we're the National Trade Association of Health Plan members across the country. You just heard from two of my AHIP Oregon members, and I speak on behalf of the rest of our AHIP Oregon group in support of House Bill 2339. Let me start by agreeing and echoing the comments that you just heard from my members, and I also want to call out DCBS and thank them again publicly for the efforts and their due diligence in pulling a large stakeholder group together that met over the last year in a well-vetted process that included everyone, and really agreement around the outcome being something that's going to support patients and keep them out of the messy process of all of this. Our focus, as you've heard from these two, is, you know, remaining on quality, affordability, and accessibility. And we think that the bill before you yields a reasonable rate for reimbursement. And for that reason, we're here to support that wholeheartedly. Thank you, and happy to answer any questions. Questions, panel? All right. Thank you very much.
John, is it Jurevic in Mannheim? Whoever.
Thank you, Chair Monis-Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Nan Heim, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Ambulance Association. Our members are public agencies and private companies that provide 911 emergency ambulance transport service in Oregon throughout the state. Our concern with this bill is that initially and apparently erroneously we thought we were not in it because it's primarily in-facility services, but in fact, apparently, we are. And the issue with emergency transport 911 service is that it is 100% non-network. So the reimbursement, I just talked to one of our members earlier today. If, for example, in Multnomah County, you call 911 and we're transported to a hospital in an emergency situation, your insurer would probably reimburse the base rate for that county, which in Multnomah is $1,000. The rate at 175% of network of Medicare would probably be about $675. So if you multiply that by all 911 emergency transport calls, the impact would be quite catastrophic on emergency ambulance service in the state. So we are going to seek an amendment probably just to be exempted for that, for those services.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Jurevic, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Oregon Anesthesiology Group, which I'll refer to here in my testimony as OAG. OAG employs almost 300 MDs and 14 CRNAs that provide anesthesia and pain management services to 10 hospitals and 25 ambulatory surgery centers, all in Oregon. We're a physician-owned practice that was founded in 1989. Nearly a third of our MDs have formal subspecialty training in trauma, pediatric, obstetrics, cardiac anesthesia, as well as critical care and pain management. Personally, I have a very extensive background in health insurance, having been the CFO of what is now Moda Health from 1997 to 2010. I'm currently serving as the chairman of the board of Della Dental Insurance Company of Idaho, and a board member of Oregon Mutual Insurance Company. Over my career in insurance and specifically health insurance, I've had numerous interactions with the DCBS and the insurance division in areas of financial regulation, market conduct, rate and form filings, actuarial, and underwriting. So, interestingly, I have a pretty broad perspective here, both the insurance company's viewpoint as well as the provider viewpoint. And I'm here today to oppose HB 2339 as written. As my colleagues had mentioned, I think we're all on the same page that we agree that the patient needs to be held harmless from balanced billing and shouldn't be subjected to large unexpected medical bills. However, this 175% solution is a simple fix, and it will, in my opinion, create unintended consequences. This bill is addressing, as many have said here already, and we concur on both sides of the discussion here, that so there's a small number of bad actors, and they're being addressed at the expense of those like us who go to great lengths to contract with all the payers in our region and avoid out-of-network reimbursements. In excess of 99% of our reimbursements are in-network. Most of our hospital partners, as the Providence spokesman mentioned, contractually require us to notify them should we fall out-of-network. In fact, we at OAG, we tie our charity policies to that of our hospital partners, and we've developed self-pay and uninsured medical emergency fee schedules to address these situations. Providers that pursue out-of-network strategies for economic reasons are they see very short-term gains. As everybody has acknowledged here, out-of-network is messy and uncertain. And the vast majority, from our own experience now, we still do get out-of-network claims. And I wanted to explain this because it could be interpreted based on the insurance industry testimonies that they go to great lengths to make sure everybody is in network. Well, I in recent history, we've been approached by many insurance companies, not necessarily the domicile ones, but some of those and the national companies that are shrinking networks. And we find after the fact that even though we do have a contract, in many cases, for absolutely no reason, we find we're out of network, and we have to then manage claims in a very different way and complicated way. Frequently, it has to do with only IT mistakes. Or we may find that due to delays in the processing of paperwork by the payers, that some of our network, some of the providers who we have been trying to get enrolled in the network are out of network. So there's a whole host of problems that are out there that are not even necessarily tied just to contracts. The 175% rule being proposed, we feel, is unconscionable for a whole host of reasons, most significantly because the commercial rates that we currently negotiate with are substantially above that. Therefore, this provides, as Dr. Bissell indicated, what we perceive as an irresistible incentive for insurers to lower their claim costs by pushing providers out of network. I can imagine a scenario where we're negotiating a contract for renewal and looking for the modest increases that we generally get, and the provider is asking for, or the payer is asking for us, and we've seen these situations where the payer comes in and says, no, you need to reduce your rates. So this, obviously, without the ability to walk away from the contract and having artificially set reimbursement rates, really puts a very significant imbalance in the negotiation process. Secondly, as I know our pathology spokesman indicated, that these Medicare rates are not market-based, nor necessarily are they what you contract for a commercial basis in one specialty are comparable on a comparable basis with CMS and Medicare rates equal at all. In fact, they're for anesthesia is notoriously under reimbursed in Medicare. We compete in a very competitive national market, and we attempt to hire and retain the best anesthesiologists. As many of you, most all of you know, the demand for MDs exceeds the supply. Forecasted shortages are well documented. Oregon is now a very attractive place to practice medicine. Please don't give this arbitrary leverage to the payers. OAG negotiates in good faith and at arm's length in the commercial market. With over 50% of our cases coming from Medicare and Medicaid, where rates are not negotiated, a successful negotiation in the commercial marketplace is absolutely necessary for us to provide competitive compensation to our providers and to provide the highest level of care to our patients. There's been some discussion of the Fair Health database, and I would echo my colleagues in supporting the Fair Health database. And in fact, just on April 18th, the NORC at the University of Chicago produced an assessment of all the national databases recommending that out-of-network physician reimbursement be tied to what is provided in the Fair Health database. Interestingly, before I came to the meeting, I went with some of my associates, and we went into the Fair Health database, and we pulled up several of our codes, which we felt were very reasonable. There's nothing complicated about this. I think it is the most comprehensive and independent database that's out there, and this is what OAG supports.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions?
Any questions?
All right.
Thank you.
Jesse O'Brien and John Bartholomew.
Go first. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the policy director for OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, statewide consumer advocacy group, here in strong support of House Bill 2339. We think this is an urgently needed measure, and we applaud the efforts of DCBS to bring together stakeholders to hammer this out. In terms of the history of this, it's already been mentioned that there was a stakeholder group that's been working on this for many months now, but I would push back the history of this several years now to when we first started discussions about Oregon's first comprehensive network adequacy legislation that was passed in 2015 in House Bill 2468, where in the discussions leading up to that bill, this issue was extensively discussed, and there was an explicit decision made to avoid solving this problem in that bill so that we could get a basic framework in place, which I would point out was a very large concession by the consumer advocates, because this is one of the biggest problems that consumers have with health insurance networks. And so I think it is well past time that we solve this problem for Oregon consumers. I think the both sides on this bill clearly agree that the underlying problem for consumers about consumers getting stuck in the middle in these billing disputes needs to be resolved. I'm not going to go into great detail about that, except to point out that this is a problem that can happen to you even if you're aware that – even if you're fully aware that this can happen to people sometimes, even if you're the savviest consumer you could possibly be of health insurance. There was an OSPIRG member who some years ago told me about his experience where he had a scheduled knee operation. He actually knew that this could happen with anesthesia in particular, and so he asked everybody involved, including the hospital, the physician, the anesthesiology group, and the insurance company, whether the anesthesia would be covered at the in-network rate. And everybody said yes. But then on the day of his procedure, the in-network anesthesiologist called in sick, was replaced by an out-of-network provider without his knowledge, and he received a several thousand dollar balance bill. And I just really think that that should never happen to anybody. For consumers, it is most critical to ensure that the rules banning surprise billing are there and that they're clear and enforceable. The specific details regarding the determination of a reimbursement rate in these situations are less critical, but if the mechanism is too heavily weighted for the interests of either insurers or providers, it could have downstream negative consequences for consumers. And we don't have a specific position on what the reimbursement rate ought to be, but we do believe that the benchmark outlined in the bill is within a reasonable range, and it does have the benefit of being clearly defined and transparent for all parties. Although we don't have a specific position on what the number should be, I would say that we would be concerned about defining the number via reference to a usual and customary rate or by reference to billed charges for healthcare services, which is the way that New York, for example, did it in their law that ties reimbursement to Fair Health, because the Fair Health number is 80% of billed charges in the Fair Health database. The problem with that is that billed charges for healthcare services often have little relationship to the actual cost of care. There's pretty extensive research on that. We don't have any specific objection to using a database or any particular database, and we don't want to besmirch Fair Health as an organization. They do great work, but I don't think that this number should be tied to billed charges. I'll just briefly mention, we do support the bill as it stands, but we do have two outstanding concerns about how the bill will be implemented that I just want to state for the record. One is that we're a little bit concerned that the plan for enforcement as outlined in this bill is not particularly clear. For it to work as intended, the prohibition on balance billing has to actually be enforceable and followed by providers, and consumers in those situations must not be subject to debt collection or damage to their credit rating. If they pay a bill, they're not liable to pay under the law. They must have the ability to recoup those funds. We're sure that the overwhelming majority of healthcare providers will do the right thing and follow this law. But if some don't, there isn't really a clear set of penalties or process for enforcement here, and we're somewhat concerned about that. We are happy to move forward with the bill as is, so as not to pose an obstacle to making progress on solving this problem. But if violations of the law prove to be widespread, we may need to revisit this issue in the future. And then the second issue I'll just very briefly flag is that we are fine with the amendment, the -A6 amendment that's been proposed, trying to scope the problem so that it is targeted specifically at consumers who did not choose to go out of network. I am a little bit concerned, though, that the way, and this isn't a problem with the amendment, it's a problem with the underlying bill. I'm concerned that an awful lot is riding on the way the word chooses is interpreted and how you define whether a consumer has chosen to go out of network. I believe that it is possible to resolve this issue through rulemaking and the implementation of the bill, but it is somewhat vague in the bill and the amendment as they stand. Thank you.
Thank you. John. Okay.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I am John Bartholomew, Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon, with our 500,000 members across the state, many of whom are not on Medicare yet because our membership starts at 50, as many of you know, and do use commercial insurance products. And I would echo very much of what Mr. O'Brien had to say about why we care about this. We have many consumers contact us about this issue over the years, but I didn't have to go very far to give an example because I've been personally affected by this. Back when I lived in Maine, I went in for an MRI. I did everything I was supposed to do. It was the same hospital as my PCP. I asked, is this covered by my insurance? Everybody's yes, 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 everything's good. About a month after the MRI, I got a bill for about $750 from the guy who reads the MRI, which I didn't even know was contracted out at the time. And so I did fight with my insurance company, ended up getting it covered eventually after some time. But I think I may be a lucky one when it comes to that. And if somebody is low income and gets multiple $1,000 bills, this can mean a lot of damage. This can mean bankruptcy. Ultimately, it can mean hurt credit. There's a lot of things that this can lead to. I have some of the same concerns about enforceability that Mr. O'Brien mentioned. And I would love to see some greater protections for those who are on Medicare, because there is a small subsection of individuals, of individual providers who formally opt out of Medicare, people could be end up being impacted by balance bills that they don't know that they're going to be affected by. But I don't believe we have the authority at the state level to do anything about that particular piece. So I will work with my federal colleagues on that piece of things.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. I will close the public hearing on Senate House Bill 2339. We will be figuring out what we're going to do with that bill. All right. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2675.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2675 requires coordinated care organizations, community advisory councils to develop and adopt a community health improvement plan that includes a strategy to integrate comprehensive health services. There is a no fiscal impact, no revenue impact as it came over, and no amendments, and it passed out of the House with 57 yes votes, 2 nays.
Okay, Deborah.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Deborah Loy. I am the Executive Director of Government Programs of Capital Dental Care, a dental care organization who provides care to Oregon Health Plan enrollees. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 75 and request your support of the bill. I also have submitted written testimony, so rather than read through it totally, I'm just going to sort of hit the high points. So the legislation that created the coordinated care organizations has a provision requiring the coordinated care organizations have a community advisory council that oversee the development of and adoption of the community health and needs assessment and community health improvement plan in order to guide the CCO and strategies for improving the health of their membership. The legislative intent of House Bill 2675 is to add a requirement that the CCO's community health improvement plan include a plan and strategy for integrating oral health as part of its overall strategies, along with medical and behavioral health. And I'm hoping the committee members can support the bill.
Was there any opposition?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. All right, thank you. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2675, and we can probably schedule a work session on that one. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2388.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2388 would grant authority to the Department of Consumer Business Services to deny, revoke, or suspend a pharmacy benefit manager's registration, specifies condition by which registration can be denied, revoked, or suspended, no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, no amendment, and it passed out of the House 56 yes votes unanimously.
Josh Free and Kelsey Wilson.
It was like that. I really like bills like that.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Josh Free. I'm the chair of the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition. It's our advocacy group representing pharmacists of all practice settings across the state. And as a pharmacist running a pharmacy, the House Bill 2388 is near and dear to me. I'm general manager for Consonus Pharmacy Services. We serve about 7,000 nursing home-based residents here in the state of Oregon. 4 years ago, starting with House Bill 2123 in 2013, the state of Oregon began an effort to level the playing field for pharmacies and the patients they serve. We're very pleased to be here today to close this chapter of PBM regulation. Supporting House Bill 2388 means not only clarifying the existing law, but also ensuring that the insurance division has the full authority to enforce the law. We're grateful to DCBS for overseeing a summer work group that had a diverse group of stakeholders at the table and negotiating House Bill 2388 as a result. The Oregon State, the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition urges your support, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Kelsey?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kelsey Wilson. I'm here today on behalf of PCMA, the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, which is the national trade group for pharmacy benefit managers. And I think this is short and sweet, and excited to be here, enthusiastically neutral on the bill. And glad that
I love that, enthusiastically neutral.
Glad that we have reached this point, and certainly agree with the intent of the bill that their DCBS needs the enforcement authority over the bad actors, and we've been at the table through the House Bill 2123. There was a bill introduced in 2016, a budget note that that had the budget note work group through the summer. We were at the table. We certainly appreciate Rick Blackwell and DCBS, the pharmacists, and Representative Nose, who worked with us on the House side to make some tweaks to the original language. And we are happy to be here and, like my colleague said, close this chapter. So thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Just a comment, and you know better. No chapter is ever closed in this building.
Okay, and DCBS doesn't have any problems with this. All right, we can schedule this for work session. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2388 and open a public hearing on 2340.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2340 A makes several technical changes to Oregon's insurance code and grants authority to DCBS to reduce the mandatory 5-year ban for insurance carriers that offer health plans in the state. No revenue impact, no expenditure impact, and came over unanimously from the House.
I don't have the sign sheet.
Oh, thanks, Richard. Sorry. I'll grab it.
Chair Monica Anderson, members of the committee, I believe Pat Allen wanted to testify on this bill, but okay. Seeing as how I'm the one that's here, I can speak really briefly on this.
Right.
House Bill 2340 is a bill that we proposed in the interim to align certain statutes related to healthcare service contractors.
You're the devil.
And there he is. Okay.
That's right.
Yeah. And multiple employee welfare arrangements with the traditional regulation of insurance carriers under the code. As we looked, it's really a numeric soup. So really, half the bill is just making these technical changes where over time the statutes may have drifted and needed to be cleaned up. The other part is working on the five-year
just
ban.
Say your name for the
oh,
record.
Oh, gosh, I'm
anyway.
So sorry.
You did say
yeah.
who you were coming
I'm
up.
I'm Rick Blackwell, Policy Manager for the Division of Financial Regulation. Thank you.
Okay.
I haven't forgot that yet. Anyway, so the other part of the bill deals with when an insurance carrier exits a market, typically individual market, they are not able to get back into the market for a period of 5 years. This is to make sure that they've made a very informed decision before they leave the market and that there's really some penalties for them exiting and there's in because of the disruption that may occur. However, we are dealing with a lot of uncertainty these days. We think that it may be useful for us to have some flexibility in shortening the ban. However, we also think there may need to be some sideboards in place for us to set up a public process, figuring out what kind of information we need to have from the carrier and make certain decisions about whether to shorten that five-year ban. And so 2340 also gives us that flexibility. There's an amendment we've requested that would put into statute more sideboards into place so that people have some certainty about what kind of rules we would adopt in setting those standards.
So where is the amendment?
The Chair Monica Anderson, the amendment
oh,
was
yeah.
requested. We just received the draft yesterday, I believe, and we've set it out for feedback for Friday.
A2
or B2?
A2.
A2?
A2.
Okay. Is there a question? All right. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill. Oh, wait. Yes. 2340A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2341A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2341A is an omnibus bill that brings Oregon statutes in line with new federal change regulations, providing DCPS the ability also to resolve state health insurance implementation issues. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal, and no amendment.
Okay, so Pat Allen, Tom Holt, and Doug Barber.
Thanks, Chair Monica Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This is the what we have come to refer to as the Affordable Care Act Reconnect bill. And you might be tempted to wonder, why are we reconnecting to the Affordable Care Act? Aren't we repealing that? It's an interesting day for this bill.
Not this year.
Well, not today, anyway. And I've been getting sort of emails about every 10 minutes from discussions going on in Congress. They're going to vote. They're not going to vote. They're going to vote. They're not going to vote. The latest as of literally 10 minutes ago is they're not going to vote.
It'll be June.
Perhaps.
To make our lives harder.
In the absence of anything else, we think maintaining our statutory connection to the federal framework is the most prudent thing to do. You should know that in the House we have a bill that we're moving that provides us a degree of regulatory flexibility in the event of federal changes that happen after you all have gone or after the rate setting process has concluded that would allow us to respond to destabilizing changes in federal law. As a way to sort of have our cake and eat it too, to be connected to the federal base law as it continues to be the law, but with that bill would allow us to have flexibility. This, however, is simply the regular reconnect that we have brought to you each session.
Yeah. Thank you, Tom and
Chair Moss Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions has described very well what the bill is for. We just wanted to flag. Couple items. One, you may recall, not very long ago, you passed out of here Senate Bill 271 dealing with the definition of small employer. So we will need to get a conforming amendment done to reflect that bill. And then just wanted to point out just a slight discomfort we have in calling out appeals for prescription drug benefits for drugs that aren't on formulary. Those appeals already exist within any review of any medical claim. It just worries us to sort of have perhaps catnip for those who like to challenge our ability to manage a drug benefit for clinical purposes. We're neutral on the bill. We would like to get that one conforming amendment.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. These are health insurance agents around the state who work with businesses and individuals. I just wanted to call your attention to three lines buried in this 24-page bill. They are on page 12 in section 9, lines 18 to 20, and it's dealing with an issue called qualified small employer health reimbursement accounts. And this is the way I understand this. This was a change in federal law late last year. Under Oregon law currently, small employers can use pre-tax dollars to buy insurance policies in the small group market for their employees. What they cannot do is use pre-tax dollars to help their employees buy individual health care, health insurance. This changes that. This says small employers can use pre-tax dollars if they put that money into a health reimbursement account to allow their employees or to help their employees buy insurance in the individual market. So the question for our agents is this a good thing or a bad thing, or do we know? And our sense is we don't know. Here's the plus side, potentially, is a small employer who currently does not offer any kind of health care benefit could decide to put $100 or a couple hundred dollars in a health reimbursement account that would help their employees purchase the kind of insurance that they may already be purchasing in the individual market. So this would be a benefit to them, and it may encourage that activity. That would be a plus. The flip side or the downside could be a small employer who currently offers small group policies to their employees may decide to back out of the small group market and instead put money in a health reimbursement account, moving their employees from the small employer pool to the individual market. Individual market in Oregon is disrupted, difficult, challenging, uncertain. So the concern, and that's about the highest level it's risen to among in the discussions that I've had with agents, the concern is if we start seeing employers pulling out of the small group market and moving their employees into the individual market. So just so that you know that this change is buried in this bill, if you start getting inquiries from your constituents who happen to be in that situation, we just want to know, let you know that it's there. Thank you.
But you're neutral on the bill?
We are.
Could I just speak briefly
yes,
to the issue
do.
Mr. Barber raises? He raises a good one, and I apologize. I should probably have spoken to that in my initial comments. Starting last summer, we spent time as an agency working on what kinds of things steps could be taken that would stabilize the individual market. One of those steps is getting people into the individual market who are there not because they're sick and need insurance, but for other reasons. And so Mr. Barber exactly correctly assesses the kinds of circumstances that would cause employers to pay premiums through this vehicle that would get their employees into the individual market. We think on balance, the effects would be more toward the side of employers that don't offer insurance being able to use this as a way to provide some kind of an insurance-related benefit without fully taking the plunge into the group business. And I guess I just want to let the record show, this is one of the very first things the Trump administration did when it took office and proposed regulatory changes through CMS to make this available under the Affordable Care Act, and we concur with this as a stabilizing impact on the individual market.
So, is it best that we not try to play around with this bill?
We think the bill should pass.
I do have a question of Tom. When we're talking conforming amendments, we're conforming this bill to 271, correct?
Chair Miles Anderson, Senator Cruz, yes.
Okay, that's fine. And also, just so you know, if things get too crazy back there, we may be back here ourselves. So, okay.
Understood.
Okay.
I would be reluctant to change anything right now unless there's really good
reason. Let's let it play.
Just let go.
I agree.
We'll
so let's schedule this for work session, too.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, as soon as we have the conforming amendment, then
that should be relatively easy. Well, I think the conforming amendments happen without us having to.
No, we don't have to do that.
We don't have to do it. They will make it. Okay. Okay. So that was the last. Is that the last bill? And we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2341A, and we're adjourned. Thank you, everyone.
Got through it.
Thank you, everyone.
Got through it.
And we're adjourned.